From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live Arts Edition. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. This Sunday, the Punta Gorda Symphony's performance season continues with their first concert of the new year. Sunday's program will feature the final large-scale orchestral work of composer Felix Mendelssohn, his famous violin concerto in E minor, featuring guest artist David Kim. Kim has served as concertmaster of the Philadelphia Orchestra since 1999. His violin studies began at the tender age of 3. He earned his bachelor's and master's degrees from the prestigious Juilliard School. In addition to soloing with the Philadelphia Orchestra, each season he also performs with orchestras all over the world. He appears as concertmaster of the All-Star Orchestra at the Khan Academy. Listeners may have seen his past performances with the All-Star Orchestra on PBS television broadcasts. He also performs each season as a guest artist with modern hymn singers Keith and Kristen Getty at such venues as the Grand Ole Opry, Carnegie Hall, and the Kennedy Center for Performing Arts. He also appears internationally at such festivals as Arizona Music Fest, the Kingston Chamber Music Festival, and the Taipei Music Academy and Festival, which he founded and served as artistic director for years, as well as the Aspen Music Festival. David Kim is also a dedicated music educator, providing performance residencies and master classes at the University of Texas at Austin, the Manhattan School of Music, and Bob Jones University, among others. He's a professor of violin studies at Cairn University, where he's also the founder and artistic director of the annual David Kim Orchestral Institute. And he serves as a distinguished artist at the Robert McDuffie Center for Strings at Mercer University in Macon, Georgia. And Mr. Kim has been awarded numerous honorary doctorates as well. David Kim, welcome to Gulf Coast Live Arts Edition. Thanks so much for taking the time to be with us.
Oh, my pleasure, John. Great to be with you.
And today's broadcast is a recorded conversation, but listeners can still weigh in with comments and questions. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. And David Kim, I wanted to start from the beginning. Given that your violin studies began at such an early age, can I take that as an indicator that music and arts appreciation were pretty heavily emphasized aspects of your upbringing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think in this day and age, it's not unfamiliar to most people to know or have heard of some, you know, super talented young musician or athlete or chess player or maybe somebody, and even in the Scripps National Spelling Bee, there are child prodigies in every area. And I was absolutely one of those people. My parents came here as immigrants from Korea in the early 60s. And, you know, when my mother became pregnant with me, she, before I was even born, she predestined my future, and she said, okay, I want to have a son, and I'm going to train this son to become a concert violinist. And then she was the quintessential tiger mom. And, you know, by the time I was 3, practicing and an hour a day, by the time I was 7 and 8, 3 hours a day, by the time I was 8, 9, you know, 5 hours a day, it was just a very, very intense upbringing. And my mother was a musician, and that's where the vision came from.
Oh, right. Yeah, that was my next question. I was wondering if she was a musician as well. Well, since the violin was more or less chosen for you, I'm wondering if at any point if you had ever considered changing instruments or if along the way you'd ever picked up any others?
No, even a little bit of verbal rebellion was met with incredibly stern correction from my mother. So, you know, I always make the joke that if I had collected a nickel from every person that I've met in my travels that says, oh, I used to play the so-and-so violin or piano, but I quit, I think I would be living on a yacht somewhere in the Greek islands. I've met so many people. And that was just not a part of our quit. It was not a part of our vocabulary as I was growing up. And it just was a part of life for as long as I could remember. And I was going to one of the great violin pedagogues of the 20th century, Dorothy DeLay, by the time I was 8. But even before I went to her, from the time I was 6, I was studying with former students of hers, or disciples, as we called them. So, I was afforded every single advantage and the best training money could buy. I mean, my parents were far from wealthy, but they just spent every last penny on traveling around, violin lessons, Juilliard, buying instruments. I guess my mother just somehow instinctively knew that it would take that kind of crazy dedication and sacrificial living from everybody in the family in order for me to make it to the top ranks, which is what she absolutely envisioned from the beginning. She was not looking for me to play violin for enjoyment and, I don't know. She just wanted me to be on the world's greatest concert stages and playing important concerts all the time.
Right. Well, you've certainly risen to that. No one could debate that. I wanted to delve, just go ahead and right into the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto, because this is, this is an iconic piece. This is pretty much like required learning for any violin student. I'm curious as to at what age you were first introduced to this piece and maybe how you think your relationship with it maybe has grown or changed over time.
I think the first time I learned it, there's kind of a hierarchy of violin concertos. There are many very famous ones, Tchaikovsky, Brahms, Beethoven, Mendelssohn, but there are kind of different levels. And so you might start with kind of some of the student concertos that many of your listeners probably have never even heard of those composers, Nardini, Viotti. And then you move on to kind of the next level, which are kind of serious concertos, but considered quasi still student concertos. And Mendelssohn goes possibly into that category. So I was, for better or for worse, probably influenced by hearing that a lot as a kid, like, oh, it's Mendelssohn, kind of a student concerto. So I didn't play it a lot as a kid. I just learned it in the course of going through all the standard concerti. Concerti meaning a plural of concertos in Italian. And I did have an opportunity. I did play it in Carnegie Hall when I was about 17 or 18 with some kind of freelance orchestra in New York, which was very exciting. But then for decades after that, I barely played it at all and ended up playing mostly Tchaikovsky concerto, Brahms concerto, so on and so forth. And then a couple of seasons ago, our music director in Philadelphia, the famous Yannick Mézet-Séguin, also music director of the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra, or Metropolitan Opera Company, asked me to play it on a tour in Korea. And that was a big deal because I'm the kind of first Korean or Korean-American, maybe you could say, to be concertmaster of one of the great orchestras of the world, leading orchestras. And so having the opportunity to travel with the Great Philadelphia Orchestra on an Asian tour and then appear in the final concert on television and live radio broadcast, and everybody in the music world in Korea was there. It was just a big, big deal, and he asked me to play Mendelssohn. So that was a turning point for me. Obviously, I prepared literally for about 2 years leading up to that moment, and I'm glad I did because while I was playing, I broke a string, and he didn't stop. He just kept on conducting, and I just grabbed the concertmaster's violin and kept playing, and that wouldn't have been possible on the fly if I hadn't been completely over-prepared.
Right.
So now I have instead of thinking of Mendelssohn as kind of a lighter, earlier concerto in one's progress, now I love it, and I consider it one of the greats. One of the masterpieces, and I think it's deservedly so. It's just such a fantastic piece, and some people recognize it, some people might not, but so accessible, beautiful, lots of virtuosity.
Absolutely. I still distinctly remember the very first time that I heard it. It was actually a recording of Itzhak Perlman with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I think I was in middle school. Like, I bought the CD that day. I'm so looking forward to your performance. I can't wait to hear it.
Oh, thanks, John.
But the three movements of this concerto are, you know, they're melodically and harmonically connected. They're played back to back without pauses. And I'm wondering if this is something of a challenge to a soloist's stamina. Like, is this a particularly physically demanding piece? I mean, aside from not really having any break whatsoever between the movements, there isn't really much of an orchestral introduction. The solo violinist starts right at the beginning of the first movement.
Yeah. Well, I think you're absolutely right on the mark. It is a lot of notes. It is all played, as we say in the business, attacca, which means each movement leads directly into the next. There's no pause. But it's less taxing rather than other concerti that may have even longer, be longer or more difficult. But I think it's slightly more kind of accessible because of the way Mendelssohn wrote. I mean, his style is light and effervescent, and so the texture is not as though you're walking through a swamp and pulling your foot out of the muck every step. It's kind of like you're gliding on top wearing snowshoes. And so that makes it so you don't have to battle the orchestra. The orchestra is not orchestrated too heavily, so you don't have to try to cut through the accompaniment. All those things combine to make it very user-friendly, and you just kind of get on your magic carpet and fly. It has that feeling rather than kind of pulling an elephant behind you.
How would you characterize the way that the piece is composed, structurally speaking? And by that, I mean, I was looking at a recent piece about you on WRTI radio ahead of a performance you recently gave of Max Brooks' first violin concerto with the Philadelphia Orchestra. And in that concerto, each movement gets progressively more demanding for the soloist. Is that the same for the Mendelssohn, or is it structured just very differently from that?
It's structured differently. The first movement is the longest in this concerto, in Mendelssohn, and it has a pretty extended cadenza in the middle, which is where the orchestra stops playing, and then the soloist kind of has a moment to expand on ideas and show off a little bit. But, in terms of proportion, certainly the Mendelssohn, the third movement is the shortest, and it just flies by.
And I had a question for you just kind of about the history of the piece. I was surprised in my research to find that this was first recorded in 1951, because I had always just kind of been under the impression, and I'm not really sure why, but that this composition had been consistently very popular from its inception in the mid-1800s.
I wouldn't be surprised. It's really, I mean, it's difficult, but it's not impossible. Like when the Tchaikovsky concerto was premiered, the soloist told Tchaikovsky, forget it. This is impossible. This is unplayable, was the word he used. And so, thankfully, the Mendelssohn never experienced those kind of growing pains or birth pains, as it were. And it's just incredibly popular and beloved piece by lots of young people.
Mendelssohn wrote the piece, I understand, over a roughly 6-year period with a significant amount of compositional and technical guidance from his friend, violinist Ferdinand David, who actually performed it at the premiere. And I was curious if, generally speaking, can you typically tell when you're tackling a solo violin piece whether the composer is a violinist themselves or in this case, relying on the advice of one?
It's hard to say a definite yes, because the Brahms concerto comes to mind. He dedicated to Joachim, who was one of the great violinists of his time. And yet, it is the most awkward piece, the Brahms concerto. It's written as if a pianist wrote it, and that's exactly what happened. I mean, Brahms was a pianist, and so it's written kind of like that. And yet, he had one of the great violinists of all time sitting right there and kind of helping act as an advisor. So it's hard to say. I think maybe the composers themselves, maybe there's a little bit of hubris involved. Maybe there's a little bit of ego involved. Maybe they're capable of composing something that's a little bit more accessible, as it were, or playable to the soloist. and yet they choose not to. Maybe there's a little something in there like, okay, here you go, try that on for size, you know, that kind of thing. Who knows? But I wish we could ask.
Right. I'm curious about the cadenza as well and what your approach is or your preferred approach to the cadenza, because I know there's some artists like Joshua Bell who have performed their own. Others have preferred something closer to the version of Ferdinand David's. How do you approach it?
Oh, I do what's right on the page and what's written. And I'm just thinking one thing as I go through the beginning, which is, it's very dramatic and it's got dramatic pauses. And John, what I'm thinking is opera. I'm constantly telling my students that you just have to be as operatic as possible. And, you know, that's the reason I'm a violinist. My mother loved the human voice more than anything. She was an opera coach in addition to her pianistic duties. And then she just thought that, well, you know, with a voice, my child could be born with a lousy voice. You know, the instrument could not be there. But with an instrument, we can train that child to become a world-class instrumentalist, even if they're not born with a beautiful singing voice. And so she thought that the violin was the closest thing to the human voice. And so there you go. That's what's always stuck in my mind and my soul. So whenever I'm playing music, I'm always trying to convey operatic, opera, you know, just drama, all the good stuff that goes into opera. That's what I'm thinking.
All right. Yeah. Well, we've talked about the cadenza. We've touched on kind of the history and the technical structure of the piece. But for radio listeners who are planning on attending your Sunday performance with the Punta Gorda Symphony, is there anything else you'd maybe want them to be particularly mindful of as they listen?
Well, you know, I know there are lots of wonderful violinists who have performed with Rafaela and, you know, the Punta Gorda Symphony. And, but I think something that's super interesting when one is hearing great violin soloists or cellists is their instruments, what they're playing on. And the fact that I'm bringing a beautiful old Italian instrument, you know, the golden period of violin making was in the early 1700s. And I'm bringing a violin made in 1750-something in Milan, Italy, by J.B. Guadagnini, one of the great violin makers. You know, just, you know, we're playing these multi-million-dollar instruments. And it's just like coming to the concert hall, and not only do you hear some of the greatest music ever written, but you also witness these works being played on instruments that are like incredible works of art from the Renaissance period. And it's like looking at a wonderful painting by Caravaggio or something. You know, it's just, it's thrilling. And I think that's a neat kind of side benefit to going to a wonderful symphony orchestra. And also, there are probably quite a few members of the orchestra who have beautiful instruments as well. And so that's always a really nice, interesting part of going to concerts, I think.
I'm so glad you brought up the instrument you'll be playing on. Yeah, made in Milan in 1757. I mean, just for a little perspective, the United States of America was not a thing yet. I think the French and Indian War was waging at that time. I mean, what is it like to be responsible for such a beautiful instrument? But, I mean, this is a piece of history.
Well, it's interesting because, like, even right now, I kind of just subconsciously I hesitated, like, I wonder if I should be broadcasting this to the world, you know, like that you're carrying around a million-dollar instrument. You know, a lot of stranger things have happened, and they've been stolen, and people have been mugged, and, you know, just all kinds of crazy stuff has happened with these instruments. It's kind of like Agatha Christie novels in real life. And so, and yet, it's like a second appendage to me, and so I can get on an airplane and it's on my shoulder. I don't even know it's there, and then I can walk down a narrow aisle and not knock one person in the head and swing it right up and put it in the overhead. You know, just like it's just such a part of me that I don't at all worry. Oh, like, oh, geez, am I ever going to drop it or anything? No, it just couldn't happen. I just have just a constant feel for the instrument in my hands, and I know how to control it at all times.
Yeah, coming down here to the subtropics, I think I'd be more worried about the heat and humidity than anything else. But, I mean, of course, there's all sorts of things you do to prevent about that. Tell me about how you prepare for a performance like this. I understand that you make an effort to design your kind of like your whole routine around practicing, including eating and sleeping schedules, exercise.
Yes, there are different stages of my preparation, but you know, especially on the day or two before and the day of, I'm very, very cognizant of how I'm eating, how I'm sleeping, exercising. I've just come to realize that performance is something that gets harder with time, you know, with age and with all various challenges of aging. And so I'm trying to create as little unpredictability as possible, because I sure don't like surprises when I'm performing. So, you know, besides the sheer number of hours practicing and the type of practicing, which is very fastidious and slow, trying to ingrain muscle memory into my not only physical muscles, but also my brain, and different parts of my brain, the memory segment of my brain, the part that deals with the stage fright, just all these different things go into trying to have a holistic approach to performance, which is hopefully routine. I perform so much, I'm trying to make it routine how I perform, how I prepare, how I wake up on the morning of a concert, how I eat that day, how I take a nap exactly for how many minutes. I'm just trying to make it as least unpredictable as possible, because it's already such a difficult and unpredictable medium by performance.
Right, right. Well, and I read in your bio you have two daughters as well, Natalie and Maggie. Have they followed in your musical footsteps? Did you start them off at a very young age with musical training, just as you were?
Well, my older one, when she was like one, I mean, she was watching me play violin all the time and picking up anything that she could around the house and using it as a violin, a shoebox or a cereal box or just anything, and a pillow. And so finally we realized she needed to play the violin. So when she was still two, we got her a 16th size violin.
Oh, wow.
No, sorry, 32nd size.
I didn't even know they made those. Oh, wow. Okay.
Oh, it's like, it's basically a toy. and then she started playing and loves it to this day. And eventually, for a long time, she really thought she was going to go into music. But then she realized she couldn't do the sacrificial, like, give up her entire studies. And, you know, she's an A student, and she didn't want to. We said, okay, Natalie, you know, we're going to homeschool you for seventh grade, and you're welcome to get D's and almost flunk out, but you got to practice. You got to show us you're going to put in the same type of practicing that Daddy did and all that. And she couldn't do it. She would study all day and then barely touched the violin for an hour at night. So after the seventh grade, she said, well, I'm going to go ahead and give that dream up. And it was a big decision. She had to mourn that a little bit. And then now she's a sophomore at a college here in Philadelphia called Swarthmore College. And she plays violin and viola there almost as a minor. She has a string quartet. She plays in the orchestra and just loved it. And she's studying to be a vet. So
right.
For me, it worked out perfectly, because it's a rough and cruel business. And frankly, I don't know if I would have wanted her to have to go into the trenches and battle in the world of classical music.
Well, that is all the time we have, but I want to thank my guest, violinist David Kim. He's concertmaster of the Philadelphia Orchestra, and this Sunday he'll be the featured guest artist with the Punagorda Symphony, performing the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto in E minor. David Kim, thanks so much for taking the time. Thank you. Our show today was produced by yours truly. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm John Davis. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, and PR for Southwest Florida.